The South Akron Youth Mentorship is exactly what the name implies. These folks mentor the youth of Akron, Ohio. If you would like to volunteer or perhaps help with a charitable donation, please visit saymentor.org and find out how you can help out today. That's saymentor.org.
Welcome to the Phil Nasons Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Phil Nasons Show. I'm happy to have you here. We'll be here for the entire hour. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll talk a little fantasy baseball, National League first baseman, number 6 through 10. And we'll also talk Oklahoma City Thunder basketball. We talked about the trades yesterday, and now we're going to talk about how they're going to look this week. We'll also talk NBA hoops with Dave Deckard, EuroLeague basketball with Emmett Ryan. But up first, we've been talking about the Utah Jazz for a couple of years, positively, in fact, and they are giant killers. Listen to the teams that they've knocked off this season. Phoenix, Cleveland, Oklahoma City, San Antonio twice, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Chicago Bulls, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Golden State Warriors, the New Orleans Pelicans, and the Portland Trailblazers. All those teams have playoff aspirations. Utah doesn't, but they're still winning. And why are they winning? Well, we're going to find out. From SLCDunk.com, Amar is in the house. Amar, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm feeling great. You know, just these playoff teams better watch out because Utah's going to be playing spoiler in the last 20, 30 games.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I got into an argument the other day. They said, Utah, they're a couple years away. I said, they're going to be an A seed or better next year. This is a fantastic young basketball team. They've been winning, knocking off giant killers. But one of the things that people were curious about was why in the world did Utah trade Enes Kanter? What value was that to trade for him, to trade him away?
Yeah, this is going to be basically that whole the one that got away situation, because you're looking at what Kanter is doing right now in Oklahoma City. He's averaging a double-double starting on a playoff team. It's kind of like what happened with the Toronto Raptors years ago when they couldn't get things done with Marcus Camby and they had to trade him away to the New York Knicks, and then he was such a big player in their playoff runs that year. So why did they trade Kanter? They basically traded Kanter because they were in a no-win situation. They had to trade Kanter. Kanter was unhappy with going from being the second big to being the fourth big, and that's conditionally what he was in some games where he couldn't get out there because Trevor Booker was playing so well on defense. And for a young guy, he's 22, who is looking for stability and security, he needs to get that long-term contract. He needs to be able to set his market price because that's what the Utah Jazz told him to do this season. And it's very difficult to do that, to have a successful contract year when you're battling for these types of minutes, minutes that are important. He doesn't have a problem with the guys on the team. He doesn't have a problem with the coaching staff. This was just an idea of economics. And that's why the Jazz had to trade him, because otherwise he would walk and they'd get nothing back. And it would be a waste of a number three pick for the Utah Jazz, a waste of developing Kanter for both of them, and a waste of a contract year for Kanter. Instead of having everybody be upset, they had to go and find that middle ground.
And that's what they did. It was something that you brought up, though, is something that I mentioned last week, and I got basically crucified for it, is that Enes Kanter, you said defense. Defensively, he was not in the top three amongst the bigs on the Utah Jazz team, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, what does he do? Now, it's because they're so much better, or he's just not known as a defender, is he?
I think part of it is who he's on the floor with. A lot of the time that we saw Kanter, and when Kanter developed that reputation for not being a very strong defender, he was playing on the floor with Trey Burke, who is also not a good defender. And he was also playing on the floor with or without Derek Favors. Derek Favors is known as a good defender, but a lot of the times he is tasked with guarding the primary offensive big. That means that in this situation, we have Enes Kanter, who has to defend the paint and protect the rim, something that he's not good at, do it even more frequently because Trey Burke is on the floor and he is kind of like a turnstile. So in that situation, Kanter's weakness is definitely in focus there. If he was on the floor with a guy like Rudy Gobert, maybe Kanter wouldn't look so bad. And we didn't get enough chance to see the two of them on the floor at the same time, which is kind of funny because out of the three normal big men for the Utah Jazz, Kanter is the best stretch big as well. But, you know, I'm not the coach, but Kanter's defense did prevent him. He has the mobility of a center, but he's playing the power forward position for the most time. And today's power forwards do have a lot more face-up ability, and they stretch the floor. And that was just a stretch that Kanter was not limber enough to handle.
And that's why he looks so good right now for Oklahoma City, because that team plays defense. And his mistakes are covered up more easily.
Definitely. That's the same thing with what happened with Al Jefferson when he went to the Bobcats, who are now the Hornets, that they had a good defensive system. They had good defenders around him, and everyone worked together to minimize the problems of Big Al. And that's what's happening. You know, Serge Ibaka is great. When Steven Adams comes back, I do expect to see Adams and Kanter on the floor at the same time as well. And Adams is just, you know, such a frenetic defender that people are going to be focused on his defense and not Kanter's defense. And that's definitely a good way. And the other thing that seems to be working out is the fact that Kanter does have such an offensive arsenal. And that's some of what Utah is going to be missing in these next few games, for sure.
And that's what Steven Adams misses, is he's not as offensive-minded as Kanter. They do different things, and they both do things well, and some things they don't do well. It is what it is. But Rudy Gobert, he threw 5 shots out of the gym against Portland. Oh, my goodness. This is a really good team, and he's a big reason why this team is knocking off these big teams, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's also another reason why they were able to trade Kanter, is because they had this guy knocking on the door like, hey, I should be starting. You know, come on, coach, you know, get me in the game. He's in the game now, and all teams hate that because he completely changes their, you know, plan A was to go in the paint. When Gobert is in there, you have to go to plan C and B because, you know, he shuts it down. And that's a huge benefit because now Utah has 2 rim defenders playing on the floor at the same time in Favors and Gobert. And they're holding these really good teams to season lows. In the 7 games that they've started together, 3 of the teams they played had season lows in their offense. Some of that is, oh, well, you know, maybe those teams are having a bad night. But a bigger part of it is the fact that you have 7'2" French guy there blocking everything.
And that doesn't hurt. And it's also doesn't hurt when you have a kid like Derek Favors who's playing great basketball, and you have another kid named Gordon Hayward that's playing great basketball. I'll tell you this, if Amara, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if they had a experienced point guard on that basketball team, a la someone like a John Stockton, maybe in that skill set, they would be a playoff team.
Yeah, you can definitely look at the guards and say that that's where the lacuna is this year. Point guard, they've kind of made their bed by drafting an 18-year-old who turned 19 in the summer. They're hoping that he gets there, and that definitely does push the clock back. But they could be a team that makes a playoff push within this exact season if they were able to trade Kanter for a successful point guard. Like Brandon Knight was also involved in the trade that day. If they did Kanter for Brandon Knight, and you know, you'd have to give more away in both cases, then you could say that the Jazz would be definitely looking at a number 10 or 9 in the West this year, and definitely maybe 8 or 7 the year after. They are a few pieces away, but you can definitely give a lot of kudos to GM Dennis Lindsay for the way that he's putting things together. You know, Alec Burke coming back next year, that's going to be awesome as well.
It absolutely will. And the great thing is people are getting opportunities to play in Alec Burke's absence, and this is going to bode well for them as they progress as a team. But they've won 2 in a row. And to tell you the truth, last Wednesday, Amar, I thought they were going to knock off Dallas too. That would have been 5 in a row. This team isn't getting blown out lately either. They're playing tough as heck.
Yeah, that's right. This is a team that is more competitive overall than some of the previous Jazz teams. You know, some of those teams would kind of tread water for the first quarter, then get destroyed in the second, and then call it a night early in the third. This is a team that actually doesn't know that they're supposed to lose to these great teams that are, you know, at the top of the Western Conference. This is a group of guys who feel like there's a chip on their shoulder. They were perhaps held back developmentally, or their coach didn't give them enough respect. With the new coach, they want to go out there and say, you know, look at me now. Look at what we're doing. We're knocking off these big teams, and we're not afraid to do it. And as a Jazz fan, as an observer, this is exactly the type of tenacity that you can definitely easily root for.
You sure can, and it's nice to see Trey Burke playing a little bit better. He's starting to get a little more confidence. He sure played well against San Antonio. We've got about 30 seconds left this week coming up. Los Angeles tonight, then back-to-backs with Denver on the road, and then back at home against Milwaukee, and then Memphis. This should be an interesting little stretch for the Jazz.
Definitely. This is probably where Utah can make a little bit more of a push. If they are for real, they are going to take care of business by beating the bad teams as well, not just going for the good teams. And that's a hallmark of a developing team. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we certainly will, and we'll talk about it all next week. Have a great week, Amar. We'll see you again tomorrow when we do our bi-monthly MVP watch.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I can't either. That was Amar, folks, and you can find him and his excellent work over at slcdunk.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. Welcome back to The Phil Nason Show. Bunch of trades last week, and, you know, we wanted to talk more about them because we haven't talked about them enough. And when I say we, please welcome from BlazersEdge.com and also my co-host on the Blazers Edge podcast, Dave Deckard is in the house. Dave, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I am doing well. That trade deadline was pretty crazy.
It was kind of silly, if you ask me, because everything happened in the last 20 minutes, too, it seemed. And I didn't even realize that Phoenix had made the trade that they made in bringing in Brandon Knight. But we've been talking about that ad nauseum around here. But I want to add a different wrinkle to this. And because you and I are in the same generation and we think a lot alike when it comes to sports and, well, pretty much most things, what I wanted to know is this. What do you think about the days that are now with the players demanding trades, especially these guys like Enes Kanter and Reggie Jackson, guys who are basically relegated to the bench, demanding trades? What do you think? What kind of message does that send? What do you think about it?
I don't have a problem with it. I think if a guy feels that he is underused, his NBA career is short. I mean, it's measured in terms of years, not decades. So one or two wasted seasons, even in a really good career, is probably 10 to 20% of your shelf life. In a not so good career, which is what you might be feeling if you're relegated to the bench, that might be half of your NBA career that you spend miserable. So I think these guys have a right to express their discontent and have a right to ask for trades. I mean, obviously you can't break the rules for them. And if a team says, we're not trading you, the guy has to live with it. And, you know, like the rest of us in life has to learn to make do with it. But I don't have a problem necessarily with player mobility. And I think if you've got that player in that kind of situation, you understand it's not ideal. You'd want to do something to rectify that if you can. And if not, then you, like the player, just have to grin and bear it. You've got a kind of a malcontent on your team, and you got to make the best of that, just like he has to make the best of not playing.
Yeah, that makes sense. To me, though, you know, you should be happy that you're in the NBA for whatever it is. And these guys aren't going to get any extra money probably because of their disgruntlement and their begging to be traded. They're, you know, NBA scouts know what these guys are worth, whether they're being used correctly in their opinion or not. But it just seems to me that it sends this funny message and then the fans go wild and then it just gets crazy. But the crazy part of this whole thing was this Phoenix trade. Now, I didn't really get it at first. Maybe I'm starting to understand it now. But you're a team that's fighting for a playoff spot and you run this three-guard offense that seemingly is working. It's gotten you to the A seed or even the seventh seed for a while, in the West, and now you take two-thirds of it away. Did that make sense to you at first? How do you explain that?
Yeah, it was interesting that they accumulated all these guards, and you were thinking, well, A, that's pretty nifty lineup until it became apparent that they had cracks in it, and B, well, which guard are they going to trade? And the answer turned out to be all of them. It was just a really interesting way to go. And it felt like Phoenix went from, hey, that team that nobody better sleep on, that they're maybe on their way up and they're the surprise team of the West, that was last year. And now this year it's like, that's a little bit of a soap opera and they're a little bit desperate and reaching right now. That said, you know, the lineup that they came out with isn't bad. I think, you know, Bledsoe was the standout guard, or at least the most exciting guard of the ones that they had, and they retained him. And then Brandon Wright, I was surprised he was available, frankly. You know, he'll do well there, I think. It'll just be, again, a matter if they can readjust that chemistry so they're playing as a cohesive unit, or whether they are just, you know, if they're just not going to gel.
I thought it was kind of strange, though. And then I didn't even see the Brandon Knight trade at first. I'm thinking, wow, I was still in shock about the Goran Dragic trade. I wasn't shocked that they traded him, but where they sent him, that was kind of surprising. And, you know, Miami became really good all of a sudden, and then they lost Chris Bosh. But when Milwaukee traded Brandon Knight, and I started to put it together, and I said, you know, if they re-sign Knight, and they more than likely will, they've actually saved themselves $4 million in cap space next year. And I thought, wow, that was pretty clever. So instead of worrying about making that A seed when we might not, let's make a real strong team for next year. And that's what they did, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and you can't argue with it. It's just shocking to have it all happen that quick. You know, that, as I said on my site, it's like, question was, oh, you're going to trade Dragic or you're going to trade Isaiah Thomas? And the answer was yes. And that kind of came out of left field a little bit. But it shows you, I mean, accumulating assets when you're an up-and-coming team is not a bad thing, because it gives you the capability to make moves like this. Now they got the player that they wanted, and they'll have to put it together.
Yeah, you're right about that. And it was interesting, though, that's for sure. Because I questioned even bringing Isaiah Thomas in last year. I thought, wow, that's not really what they need. And now we know why they did it. You know, he's playing chess. And I think that's a good thing for the NBA. It's going to shake things up, and it made Miami a lot better in the short term and probably the long term. But if you had to pick a winner, of who do you think won this trade deadline? Who is it? Initially, I mean, okay, I know we have to wait a year before we'll know, but who do you think on the surface?
The entire trade deadline of all the teams who made moves?
Yeah.
I think that was a smart move for Miami, as you indicate. Now, do I think it returns them to glory? I don't know about that, but I think probably that they got the piece that they needed most. Phoenix didn't do badly. They got rid of a lot of headaches and got a nice backcourt going forward. Some of the other teams I'm not as sure of. I don't know how Detroit's going to do, frankly, and I'm not sure what they're up to. But again, they are a team that's very much in progress. I think the Blazers did okay with Oflalo. I don't know that he's going to be an enormous difference maker, but they certainly got more solid, and they got pretty much right down the middle of the player that they needed. So they did well enough. But I think I would probably say Miami did the best, made the single best move in picking up Dragic. They're going to be able to use him, and I think he'll play well for them.
Yeah, they looked good last night, too. And we're taping this on Tuesday, so it was Monday night. They looked pretty good. They picked up the pace big time, and he has a lot to do with that, I'm sure. Luol Deng looked good, too. That was a great trade. I thought Pat Riley, that's the third time he's reinvented the Heat since he's been there. I thought that was good, but I said this last week, and I'm going to say it again. I think the Portland Trailblazers are the ones who won that trade deadline, because I think they got what they needed. And as you mentioned on our show that you and I do, called the Blazers Edge Podcast, is, you know, they wanted to appease LaMarcus Aldridge, and they got a guy who they can probably will opt into his contract next year. So you're looking at a stronger bench, alongside these young kids like Myers Leonard, who's starting to come on. I thought Portland won that trade. I think Aflalo is going to be fantastic for that basketball team.
Well, Portland got what they wanted out of that trade, certainly. I mean, Denver got young players, but more than that, well, they got a young player in Will Barton. They waived everybody else. Victor Claver is gone. Thomas Robinson is gone. So basically what they wanted was out from underneath salary, and that's what they got. And we'll see what they manage with Barton. They might turn him loose a little bit in a way that he couldn't fly in Portland's system. So maybe he'll flourish there. But yeah, the Blazers won the talent portion of that competition for sure. But Denver, I think, is not dissatisfied. Oh, first round pick, we should mention too, obviously. Although that's a couple years down the road. But still, both teams did well. It's one of those teams where one of those trades where they look at each other and say, thumbs up, we were glad to do business with you.
That's a good way to put that. Portland won the talent competition and Miami won the looks. But who's going to be crowned NBA champion because of it? Now that's the final tally. And we'll talk about that some other day. Dave, thanks a lot for pinch hitting today and being on the show.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
All right. We'll see you tomorrow. That was Dave Deckard, and you can find him over at BlazersEdge.com. He's also the co-host of the Blazers Edge podcast. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. Welcome back to The Phil Nason Show. The Oklahoma City Thunder have some tough games ahead of them. They're minus Kevin Durant. We've already heard about that, even though they are winners of six straight, which is the first time they've done that this year. They are in for a world of interesting times ahead of them with Phoenix and Portland coming up. And joining me to do just that, to talk about the Phoenix and Portland, and we'll even talk about the L.A. Lakers game, which might be interesting too. Please welcome from WelcomeToLoudCity.com, J.A. Sherman is in the house. J.A., how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Phil, it's great to be back this week and talk about some very key games for the Thunder this last phase of the season.
And they are key games because Kevin Durant is not out or not in the lineup for the rest of this week for sure. He'll be reevaluated next week. We talked about that yesterday. But they still have some games ahead of them. Phoenix are on Thursday night and Portland on Friday on the road. They are now on the road for four of their next five games. This should be fun, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's going to be a great test for this team as they're trying to incorporate all of their new pieces. And the early returns have been good. But, of course, those have been against very weak defensive teams, especially against the Nuggets. So I think these next two games are going to be very critical to just testing to see how the Thunder are performing.
And it'll be good to see Phoenix with their new team, too, and that ought to be interesting. You know, the funny thing is that all three teams, Phoenix, Portland, and Oklahoma City, are adjusting to their new players, but Phoenix still has their team pretty much intact. Portland definitely does. Which is the tougher game, Phoenix or Portland?
Well, this is my take. I think Phoenix has pretty much punted on the season. They traded away Isaiah Thomas. They traded away Goran Dragic. And so they've lost a lot of their offensive firepower, and right now they're only a game over 500 as of what I'm looking at right now. They're 2-8 in their last 10, and so I think they're just trying to figure out how they can reload for next year. So I don't see them as a playoff threat. However, they do play a style of basketball that is so radically different from any other team that it's always going to be tough to match up, especially against the Morris Twins. And so that'll be a good test for the Thunder. But the Friday game against the Portland Trailblazers, that is important. And it's important not just because the Trailblazers have already beaten them this season, especially the last time they played, there was an epic meltdown in the fourth quarter by the Thunder. But also because those Trailblazers are sitting at number one in the Northwest Division. They're number four in the overall race. But they're losing ground. They're only 4-6 in their last 10. They've lost two in a row as of today. And they're starting to weaken as we saw them do last year. And I think that there could be enough instability there for the Thunder to make a surprise move in that division. So this is a really important game this Friday.
I think Portland's going to wax you.
All right. Well, what are you seeing in them that tells you that?
it's just a little bit of a slump. You know, they're still a very good basketball team. And now they've added Aaron Aflalo, so they're going to have to make some adjustments. But at the end of the day, LaMarcus Aldridge is unguardable, and you don't have anyone to guard him.
That's right. Yeah, we got rid of Kendrick Perkins, who was always a very good defender against Aldridge.
And you got rid of your best wing defender or let him go last year in Cephalosha, and you never replaced them either, him either. Oh, I'm sorry, you have Deion Waiters now. But the great Deion Waiters.
Yeah.
Oh, Neon Deion.
The greatest.
Who's just, yeah, he's the best. I mean, he came, well, never mind. He's not even worth talking about. But honestly, the thing is with them is, okay, your point guards will probably cancel each other out. Westbrook will get his. Damian Lillard will probably get his. The shooting guard, Wesley Matthews, has got the edge for sure. And down low, Robin Lopez is a better offensive player than Enes Kanter is. They have Lopez back. They're a different team. They're just making some adjustments. This happened last year. I don't think that they're weakening. They're like any other team. They go through highs and lows. It's just that their lows always happen right after the All-Star break for whatever reason. I don't know what that is or why that is, but it is what it is. But I think they're going to regroup, and this is a big game for them too. And they want to prove that they belong in that upper echelon. It's going to be on national TV, which Portland games are rarely shown on national TV. And it's going to be one of those fun games where you're going to see some great play from both teams, but I think Portland's going to smash them in the end.
I think the one edge that the Thunder have is that they have a higher level that they can reach on the defensive end. And I think one of the key facets that we've seen over the last three games is that Serge Ibaka is starting to get back to what he does best. Up until this point, he'd become very committed to the three-point shot, which he's good at, don't get me wrong, but it takes away from so many other aspects of his game, and it makes him less aggressive. But now that he's getting back to getting in the lane, and he's grabbing rebounds, he just had his first career 20-20 game last week. He had 8 blocks against the Nuggets, and to see that kind of focus on the interior of the Thunder defense is very promising, especially with Steven Adams out. I think that the Thunder defense has a much higher level that they can reach than the Trailblazers do. And especially on the when we get into the bench unit, I think the Thunder bench is now vastly superior to what it was even a month ago. Much more offensively competent now that they have DJ Augustine, who understands his role as a backup point guard, and he's much more engaged than Reggie Jackson was. And so I think that while the starting five, the Trailblazers may have an advantage there in the totality, I think the Thunder may be ready to pull off a really good upset on Friday.
Yeah, we'll have to see. But they being Portland, their bench got better too over the trade deadline. They added Aaron Aflalo and Alonzo G, and the Myers Leonard, is starting to play a little better. I mean, it's pretty hard to guard a 7-footer who can shoot threes. He's got a nice stroke. They're going to be okay. It's going to be a great game for sure. And I still think that Portland's going to come through, especially at home. You need that extra fire from Kevin Durant. Portland isn't Denver, and they're not Charlotte. And people are getting a little too excited about, and it's nice to see. They're a dangerous team, the Thunder. I've never said that they weren't. But they're only dangerous when they have all their cylinders firing at the same time, and they don't have Kevin Durant. And if you want to knock off a team like Portland, you better hope to God that you have Kevin Durant on the floor, and he's not going to be there. And that's why I say what I say, that he's a big whatever season, and I think it's fantastic that Russell Westbrook is having the season that he is. He can't carry that team alone. He needs somebody to step in and score, and I hate to break it to you, but Enes Kanter ain't it.
I don't know. He's got 2 double-doubles in his first 2 games. In the last game, Russell Westbrook only took 12 shots. He had 17 assists on the night. He was setting up everybody on the court. I think we're seeing the next level of Westbrook's evolution, and I think it's going to be exciting. I absolutely agree with that. The one thing I do love about the Trailblazers, though, is that they have such a strong identity about who they are as a team. They know exactly who they are, what they're trying to do, and they keep working at it until it starts to work in the game. And that's something that the Thunder have always kind of struggled with. They always knew that they have Westbrook and they have Durant, and they've got some other key pieces like Ibaka. But in terms of knowing exactly how to execute it at certain parts of the game, that's always eluded them a little bit. And that's why I think it's promising to see what they're doing now, is they seem to be solving some of those issues. But that said, the Blazers are still superior in that regard. And so even if the Thunder are able to carry a lead at any point in the game, you have to be wary of how the Blazers are playing, because they know how to play together and to make up ground and get wins in the end. And that's exactly what we saw happen in the last time these two teams played.
And that's what it is. It's coaching. And that's something that the Oklahoma City Thunder doesn't have. Good coaching like Terry Stotts. That's a difference maker. And if it's close, that's the difference maker. He actually can draw up plays in the huddle. Scott Brooks, well, it is what he is. That's what's going to hold the Thunder back. But it should be a fun game, and it'll be Friday night, and it should be interesting to see what happens, and hopefully that the Thunder continue to stay healthy, minus Kevin Durant, and they can hang on to that eighth seed. Nice stuff today, J.A. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, sir.
All right, that was J.A. Sherman, and you can catch him over at welcometoloudcity.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
The Phil Nason Show will return after these brief messages.
Riveting talk radio.
People cannot get away from the internet.
Well, I think it probably comes from porn as well. You know what I mean? That's got to be a big, strong thing.
Oh, that's gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Dog radio. Bend over, baby.
That was great.
FanDuel and the Phil Nason Show have partnered to bring you a very special offer. FanDuel will give you a 100% signing bonus of up to $200 with your first-time initial deposit. To receive this bonus, simply sign up at FanDuel using the promo code PhillyFlash and go win some cash with a flash at FanDuel.com.
Central Portugal's only English-speaking information station, this is Epix Radio. Listen online, www.epixradio.com.
If you're looking for a great Portland Trail Blazers talk radio show, then look no further than the Blazers Edge podcast with Dave Deckard and Phil Nasons. For weekly hard-hitting commentary about your Trailblazers and fun NBA talk as well, please try the Blazers Edge podcast at BlazersEdge.com.
Maximum Sports Channels is more than just a radio station. Phil's Fantasy Sports Blog, The Writer's Garret, up-to-the-minute news feeds, great sports and entertainment commentary, Maximum Sports TV, including professional powerboat racing, and of course, the hottest music on the planet. Maximum Sports Channels, we're more than just a radio station.
You're listening to AFR, the Armed Forces Radio Network.
Hi, we're Don't Forget, and you're listening to Phil Nason's Show.
Tells me lies. Oh, yeah! That's what you do.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. EuroLeague got a little more exciting. Special K, the AK-47, Andrea Kirilenko is now a member of CSKA Moscow. And we've got some other signings. And joining me to talk about that, and maybe we'll even get into some of the games, please welcome from BallInEurope.com, Emmett Ryan is in the house. Emmett, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Phil. It's been a crazy week for rumors, never mind the actual signings in EuroLeague. The two we do know, the one you just mentioned, Andrei Kirilenko signing with CSKA Moscow, having been waived by the Sixers. The other one, Gal Mikel, after being released by the Pelicans, he signed for Nizhny Novgorod. There are two big upgrades at the midpoint of the top 16 part of the season, which could have huge implications for the games ahead.
Well, you ain't kidding there now. CSKA Moscow, this has always been the rumor that Kirilenko would wind up there. Are you surprised that he signed now? Because I'm sure the buyout was incredible from Philly, but were you surprised that he decided to go to Europe, back to Europe, and not stay in the NBA?
Well, you'd wonder, you know, did anyone really see a value in him this season? I think most people assumed when he got to Philly, well, he's staying in Philly because Philly are tanking and they can just use AK when they want to just, you know, do something with him. Like, he's not going to be a huge difference maker at this stage for a team which is tanking in the NBA. But obviously they decided, nope, we'll just get rid of him as part of our hilarious tank job, it's got to be said. But like for CSKA, obviously he's a big upgrade. And the question everybody's asking in Europe this week, and don't really know until Thursday evening our time, your afternoon, is do we have the same AK that was the same one that was there during the lockout year of the NBA? Because, of course, AK didn't come back at all during the lockout. He spent that full year in Moscow, 2011-12, won the EuroLeague MVP with CSKA, got to the EuroLeague final as well, and, of course, lost on a shot by Georgios Princesis with 0.07 of a second remaining, which led to Olympiakos lifting that EuroLeague title. Kirilenko comes back to CSKA, a team that most people would agree is loaded and probably the best team in EuroLeague so far to date this season. They've looked pretty good in their own league, the VTB league. They sit second there, and most people think to eventually win that title. So they're favorites on two fronts here, and they've just gotten stronger. So for them, signing AK is absolutely massive. The only question is, how much of the player that we saw dominate EuroLeague three seasons ago is left? Because if he's even half that player, he's an upgrade. But it's just going to be interesting to see what he does for CSKA and how he fits into Itudis' system.
Well, I think he's going to fit in just nice. You know, he's a great player. I know he hasn't played much this year, but still, he's an NBA player. He's a sixth man on most teams, that type of NBA player. Not to belittle anything that happens in Europe, because that's great basketball. He's going to be fine. If he's healthy, he'll be fine.
Yeah, obviously the one concerning thing most people have is he didn't play that much basketball this season in the NBA. So is there a bit of rust that needs to be shaken off? If it turns out that isn't the case, yeah, he's going to have a lot of success, I think, in the back end of the top 16, because he'll be going in reasonably fresh, not too much wear and tear on the season. There's a lot of chance he can have a big impact. Our first chance to see him in action will be this Friday, as the 27th. That's when CSKA hosts Fenerbahce in a pretty big game, it's got to be said, in Group F. CSKA, it's an early enough start. It's a 6 o'clock CET. That's at, just counting backwards there, that's 2 o'clock Eastern for that game. And, that's midday Eastern. I can't do my maths. So midday Eastern, CSKA hosts Fenerbahce. Both those sides looking like they're going to be going to the playoffs. In fact, it'd be very surprising if either misses out, never mind both. CSKA, of course, looking to get a home advantage situation in the playoffs there. If they beat Fener, they have a huge sort of, you know, home serve advantage, so to speak, for the final run in that regard. And adding Kirilenko is a huge plus for that. It'll be interesting to see how many minutes he gets, because he only arrived in Moscow today. So you're talking a 48-hour turnaround between signing for the team and suiting up for the first time. We see that in the NBA all the time, but it's a bit of a longer flight from Philly to Moscow than most of the flights you see in the NBA, Phil. So that's going to be interesting. The other big move in Europe, of course, is in the same group. Nizhny Novgorod, who have really looked like a team. They have Taylor Rochester as their star. They look like basically a team who need scoring support for him. They got a big addition, also an NBA player, not a Kirilenko center player, it has to be said, but Gal Mikel, who has done quite a lot in Europe to date in his career, knocked around the NBA for a couple of seasons, played a lot of D-League. He's back in Europe now, at least until the end of the year with Nizhny Novgorod. And for them, that's going to be very interesting on the two fronts. They got their own domestic league, where they obviously would like to go deep again in the VTB United League. That's the Russian and a few other teams in that league. But also in EuroLeague, where with 7 games to go, they're 2 games out of the playoffs. So they're in a situation where they need a hot streak. They need a good run. They need to basically score more in order to actually be more competitive in games. That's doable. That's well within their compass. And the way it shapes up now is, just to give people a bit of a picture, CSKA Moscow and Olympiakos and Fenerbahce, after 7 games of 14, they're all 3 of those looking very strong for those playoff spots. The other 3 teams right behind them, FS Istanbul, who won the Turkish Cup the weekend, beating Fenerbahce, Laboral Vitoria, who are doing quite poorly, my apologies, in the Spanish league, but keeping it together in EuroLeague 3 and 4, and then Nizhny Novgorod at 2 and 5. So if they get the right wins over the right teams in the run-in, it's doable, but they need Gal Mikel to be a lot bigger player than we think he is right now in order to have an impact.
He's going to be hungry. You know, this is one of the things that people don't understand, is that some of these guys that come over from Europe and you see them sitting at the end of the bench doesn't mean they can't play. And some of these guys are fantastic. Gal Mikel is one of those kids. He just got kind of lost in the shuffle over there in New Orleans and the other stops he's made. He's going to come in and immediately help that basketball team because he's fresh. He's been practicing against the best players on that team all season long. He's fresh, and I'll bet you he's hungry, and I wouldn't want to try to stop this young fella anytime soon.
And also, he's used to playing on underdog teams in pressure situations in Europe. In the Israeli league, he played for Galal and for, I actually remember the second team, Maccabi Haifa. Sorry, Galil, not Galal. My apologies to Israeli listeners. Basically, both those would be lesser teams in the Israeli league. But in the Israeli finals in 2011 and 2013, he won the Israeli league, helped them in both cases to winning that Super League title. And so, 2010 and 2013, so he's been there, done that, by beating up the big dog for a smaller team. He knows what's required for that. In terms of the games this week, though, oddly, even though all the trade action is in Group F, the 2 games that jump out for me for very different reasons are in Group E, one of whom involves a team which Phil likes to call the greatest European basketball team in the world, Panathinaikos. They travel to Tel Aviv to take on Maccabi. Very interesting matchup that. That's on Thursday, just for anyone who wants to tune in online. That'll be at 8:45 CET, so that's 2:45 Eastern time. The reason that one jumps out to me is because at the moment, that's second place third, both teams on 5-2 records. Maccabi technically in third on points differential and head-to-head with Panathinaikos. So if Panathinaikos can even keep that game close, they don't even have to win. They'll fall behind Maccabi temporarily, but they'll have a big advantage over them for jumping back over them again down the stretch. So that's an interesting one in that Panathinaikos, they don't need to win. If they can just keep that one close, they'll be happy enough with the job they've done there. The other game, of course, involves the most difficult to understand team in European basketball. That's Friday at 2:45 Eastern, 8:45 FC Barcelona, that's not the one I'm talking about. They host Alba Berlin, who, let's just remember here, they've lost to teams who most people can't pronounce. They've beaten the San Antonio Spurs. They've beaten Real Madrid. Maccabi Tel Aviv in Tel Aviv. They've beaten Barcelona. They've basically beaten the big teams and lost to the who as a rule this season. So they're traveling to Barcelona, where on paper it should be, Barca just walks this. But based on the form book, we have no idea what's going to happen. And if Alba win, they should jump Barcelona into fourth spot in the standings. So very exciting week in Group E for 2 very different reasons. One's more about jockeying for position. The other one's about survival in the playoff hunt. So that Barcelona-Alba game Friday, it's going to be really, really hot.
I'm very happy that the greatest team in Europe, Panathinaikos, is taking on Maccabi on Thursday. I don't have any radio on Thursday afternoon, so I'm actually going to watch that. That's going to be fun to see. Panathinaikos takes that one, only because I say they will. Now, the other one, Alba Berlin, I'm going to start referring to them as the Utah Jazz of EuroLeague, because Utah has slain all the Giants, too, and seems to lose to the Philadelphias of the world. So it is what it is, but this is going to be a fantastic week of EuroLeague. The games are on Thursday and Friday. They start around 12 noon Eastern, both days, and it should be a lot of fun. Check your local listings and enjoy yourself. And you enjoy yourself too, Emmett. And thanks for being here once again.
Thanks, Phil. Always a pleasure.
All right. That was Emmett Ryan. You can catch him over at ballineurope.com, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. We're wrapping up another amazing day of sports talk. And joining me to do a little fantasy baseball, first baseman, number 6 through 10, please welcome from rotoadvice.com. He's also one of the co-hosts of a brand new show called the Peachtree Hoops Podcast. Please welcome Jason Walker to the show. Jason, what's up? How are you?
Hey, Phil. Doing good. Getting a good tan down here in sunny Florida and enjoying it while the rest of the country digs themselves out of ice and snow. So my hat's off to you guys who live up there. I don't know how you do it.
Neither do I, but I'm struggling through, and thanks for reminding me of this wonderful weather we're having. But you know what gets me all warm and fuzzy and thinking of spring? Fantasy baseball.
Yes, sir.
First baseman. We talked about the top five first basemen last week on Friday's show, and this week we're going to talk number 6 through 10, and I'm just going to go and give you number 10 right now. I think it's my number 10 ranked National League first baseman, Lucas Duda.
Wow.
Outfielder, first baseman, New York Mets. I like him. He had a good year last year, a career year. 30 bombs, 74 runs scored, 92 RBIs. He walked less, but then he struck out less. But he still struck out 22% of the time. Those are encouraging signs, though, because he struck out a lot more the year before. I don't expect him to do more than he did last year. And if he comes close, his dual eligibility makes me happy.
Yeah, I like Lucas Duda. He doesn't make my top 10, so you've got somebody in there that. But Duda was very underrated and hit well pretty much no matter where he was. So that was he wasn't really too negatively impacted by his home park, as I recall. So, I mean, he's a great power source, solid guy, and you could probably get him later than people of similar talent and statistics. So that's a good pick. I'm going I'm taking a chance on my number 10 pick is Adam Lind, who comes over from the American League, where he was a slugger out there for Toronto last year. He's in Milwaukee now. I love that lineup. I love the Milwaukee lineup, and love having Lind in there. One thing about him, he always reminds me of one of those old softball players, you know. Guy would just go out there and mash, run around, get the second base, drink a beer, mash, come on back in. He just seems like he's just a slugger.
Oh, yeah.
Loved watching him hit. Little availability issues last year for Toronto. Hopefully he'll be able to get in at least 135, 140 games. Think he's going to be great. I love Adam Lind.
I think so, too. I like Adam Lind. He did not make my top 10, but there's always Friday. Number 9, Matt Adams, first baseman, Cardinals. My man, Hoss Cartwright. I love Hoss Cartwright. He had a kind of an interesting season last year. His ISO dropped a lot. You know, his strikeout rate as well as his walk rate dropped. But his BABIP of .338 makes his .288 average a little bit low, I think. And maybe he was the victim of some bad luck, but I think this is the real deal. When they traded Alan Craig, that kind of solidified that deal. And I think Adams is my number 9 guy for that reason.
Yeah, he's my number 9 guy, too. And you talk about guys that they look like softball players. Matt Adams certainly qualifies. He might have 2 beers at second base. But he does mash. You're hoping for a little more power than he provided in, over 550 at-bats last year. Very strange. But, maybe he's just got Sean Casey power. Casey was a similar type guy. I think if Adams can stay stable in that lineup, which was always a question before they made that move. You're hoping he could get some of those counting stats up from last year. So the Cardinals, typically you can depend on them, and Adams being there, he's got the availability, he's got the volume, so he's a solid pick at number 9 for National League first baseman.
Hoss Cartwright, I love Hoss Cartwright. My number 8 guy, Mark Trumbo, first base, outfielder, Diamondbacks. I'm a dual-eligible guy, so he's right up there. He had some difficulties there with the injury last year, but I'm thinking 2015 should be a very interesting one if he can stay healthy.
Yeah, he's underrated. He's my number eight also. We're in sync right now, although we're not going to do any singing.
Well, that's why laughed. I thought you laughed because I put him at number eight.
No.
Because he is underrated, you know. I think, too. Yeah.
He's underrated. I did a look at Jose Abreu last year and was saying, is he more Albert Pujols in his prime or more Mark Trumbo? And I was really, you know, not to disparage Trumbo, but Trumbo to me was more of the prototypical, you know, swing and miss power guy. But I was surprised to see, you know, that Trumbo, while not being Albert Pujols in his prime type productive, was surprisingly, you know, productive. Yeah, if you're playing it in an on-base percentage league, you know, Trumbo's going to drop a little bit. Batting average is still going to be low. But he is a great slugger. He's in a great park. And, you know, I like Trumbo a lot. But you did mention the availability issues last year, injury, less than 100 games. But if he gives you, you know, 130, 140 games, you're looking at between 25 and 30 dingers, and that is going to be critical.
It most certainly is, and I'm fired up for Mark Trumbo. I might have to take him if he's still around when I'm ready. My number seven guy, Joey Votto, first base, Reds. I didn't like his season of 2014. He got injured. He only played 62 games. In 2013, he played every single one. What do you do with Joey Votto at number seven? That's where I have to put him.
Well, you know, I talked about it last time. I thought Votto, if he plays the volume of games we're accustomed to him playing, he could be the second best first baseman overall behind Goldie. So I'm a big fan of Votto, obviously. So I had him in my top five, as we discussed last time. I've got Brandon Belt as my guy here. And Belt, I think, took a step forward last year. Kind of he and Rizzo were two of the type of guys that I really liked going in to last year, and I think Belt would have well been on his way, but you know, obviously he suffered the injury. I think he's got great power, a very solid space in that lineup, gonna put up good counting numbers. You know, if he gives you 140 games, I really like what he's going to be able to produce. I like Brandon Belt quite a bit, and I'm willing to bet on him again in 2015.
I like Belt. We'll talk about Belt on Friday again because he'll probably make my sleeper list. But he had a pretty decent year, and now that Pablo Sandoval's not there, you know, the only problem with Brandon Belt is that he has to platoon with Buster Posey, and I look for Posey to play more first base this year than he did last year, but it's still a great pick. Can't argue with you. Even though he never made my top 10, it still doesn't matter. Now, here's one that you might not like. Todd Frazier, third base, first base, Reds, my number six. Another dual eligible, that seems like a pattern with me.
Yeah.
But Frazier is really good. I like Frazier.
Yeah, I've got him on my third base list. I don't put him in here, but I love Todd Frazier. Being a big Reds guy like I am, I got to watch Todd quite a bit last year and loved his contact, good hard contact. His numbers are very, very high across the board there. I love Frazier's power-speed combination. I don't expect him to run quite as much because Brian Price had everybody running last year since Cincinnati. Even Jay Bruce got sent out on the base pads. But I like the fact that he's able to do it. Yeah, like I said, he's a masher. Love him at third base. When we get to third base, when you'll hear Frazier's name pretty high up. But my guy, you know, my last guy is in Colorado, and Justin Morneau. I liked Morneau a lot in Minnesota. Going through all the things that he went through, obviously you can't count on him to play 150 games. I don't know who you can count on to play 150 games anymore, but I like Morneau. Obviously, you know, park factors, et cetera, but he can still hit, still good hard contact. You can count on him out there. And, you know, if he is available more than he typically is, you got a really great bargain wherever you're taking him.
That's true. I like Morneau, but, I don't like the injuries. That makes me nervous. And other than that, though, he had a great year. And in Colorado, boy, oh, boy, he's a masher there. He hits the ball in the air, and it travels. And you got to like that. And I like this list, and I like yours, too. And it'll be fun to see who you choose for sleepers, and it'll be interesting who I pick. And we'll see you Friday. Thanks, Jason.
You got it, Phil.
All right, that was Jason Walker. And you can catch him over at rotoadvice.com. And that's going to wrap it up for today's show. Until next time, you all take care of yourselves. Be good. And most importantly,
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you.